And tonight on Coast to Coast AM, we're going to be talking about the accounts of people who have had life-changing paranormal experiences. It's called Fringeology, and the author is Stephen Volk. And we'll be back with Stephen in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Stephen Volk has been working as a city reporter since 1997, covering every facet of city life, particularly crime, cops, courts, politics, education in Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, culminating in an ongoing relationship with the Philadelphia Magazine, which happens to be one of the largest city magazines in America focusing on real journalism. Stephen, what is that? I think people are forgetting what real journalism is.
Yeah, it's a lot of work and a lot of time that goes into it. I mean, I'll spend regularly, we call it doing a deep dive, you know, at least 4 weeks on a story. Occasionally I have to do one in a quicker turnaround, but I've spent as long as 6 months, 9 months covering a single story.
You know, the internet, at one respect, has been great for news coverage because it's quick, it's immediate, and we all find out what's going on. But on another hand, Stephen, it's hurt the newspaper business, and I think that's hurt the ability to develop some really quality investigative work.
Yeah, I think long-term it's going to be a good thing as we sort it out and sort through it. And I like the democratization of information and news that comes from the internet. I mean, in general, I'm excited about what it's going to become. But I think right now there are a lot of growing pains involved. And, you know, even here I start back full-time at the magazine in July, and I will be doing a lot more on the internet. And it certainly will be something of a compromise in terms of the time we can spend on longer stories. So it's going to take time to turn the revenue around and bring in people who maybe work the internet side of things and then people who work the print side of things and can continue to do those deep dives.
Well, do you think one day, though, it'll ever change?
Do I think what will change?
We'll get this turnaround where the internet will really start helping the news gathering business instead of hurting it?
Well, look, I think that the money is eventually going to come a little more onto the internet side. I don't think it will ever be as much money as we've had on the print side. It's just a different structure and a different business model. But I do think that revenue is going to pick up. And I think, look, people have to have information. They have to have credible information. And there's a cost for developing that. And it's just going to take, I think, some visionary people to figure out how to create publications that really work in this new world. And there are some magazines out there that are doing a good job with it and making more money than they were 5-6 years ago.
Yeah, that's true, too. Now, so here you are. You know, you're a city reporter. You're a beat reporter. You've done it all. You've done it all in terms of print. I did exactly what you did, but in the radio and television end.
Right.
So you end up, as I did, covering some paranormal stories, being interested in it. You wrote it with this book, Fringeology. How'd that happen?
It's personal.
Oh, that, personal. Does that mean you're not going to tell me?
No, I'm going to tell you all about it. I'm going to tell you all about it. That's the whole point, right? So I grew up with this family ghost story in my background. And the trouble started, I'll just go ahead and tell it to you. The trouble started when I was about 6 years old. So I have fragmentary memories of it myself. There was a banging, thumping sound that would start up in the middle of the night and wake literally everyone in the house out of bed. And my sisters down the hall would swear that it was coming from their room, from up in the walls of their room. My brother and I thought it was coming from the ceiling of our room. We shared no adjoining wall with our sisters, so it was something of a mystery as to where this noise was coming from. And to our parents downstairs, it sounded like it was coming from the very roof of the house. And it was loud enough, it was a pretty big house, George, that it would wake them up out of bed.
Wow.
Too. Yeah, it was a real booming sort of noise. And there was more than noise, or at least my sisters, who were 12 and 8 years old at the time, they said they were enduring some really strange things. The blankets were pulled from their beds in unison to just sort of fall on the floor. These things happened multiple times. They said their beds themselves, the frames, would just start shaking, and they'd start screaming. And believe me, I remember that. They said they saw a ghost, that an old woman walked through the room. And my parents, as I think a lot of parents would, George, and maybe even as I would, they set those complaints aside.
Yes.
Because these were kids telling the story, and my parents had only been experiencing this noise directly for themselves. So they looked for mundane explanations, right, and they couldn't find any. I have some memories of them opening and closing closet doors really loud, banging on walls. They tried to figure what plumbing problems might have been causing this, but the noise went on for so long, tens of minutes whenever it occurred, and it was so loud, and it would go away and come back. It didn't match any plumbing problem they were aware of. And after about 9 months of this, they were at a loss. They did not know what to do, and certainly they were tired of getting woken up in the middle of the night once, sometimes two times a week. So at the time, we were a family of practicing Catholics. I'm not sure we were ever very good at it, but we were practicing. And my dad went, and he told the family priest about this. And the priest suggested that rather than get involved in all the red tape necessary to take some action directly related to a ghost, the church has a lot of rules about that sort of thing, he'd just come over and bless the house. So I'm not
so,
sure.
So he was willing, Stephen, to come and do something.
Right off the bat. And, you know, it's funny, George, you pick up on that because my dad, when he related the story to me, he said that, well, usually in cases like this, this is what the priest said. And it's just sort of funny because it suggests to you, right, he's heard this enough that he has a protocol, right? Usually in cases like this, this is what I do. And so he came and he did that. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with this, George, but Catholics often have the priest come over and bless a new house that they're moving into. And so that's what he did, is that same ceremony. And he came over in his vestments, he sprinkled holy water in the corners, and he prayed. And I remember that as he left, he turned to my father and he said, I'm sure everything will be fine. But everything wasn't fine that night. That night, the noise started up louder and went on longer than it ever had before. And we kids, we were scared. We ran downstairs to our parents, and the noise continued on above us. And you could just sort of feel the floor shake. My parents had about had enough at this point, and they were seriously considering leaving and just getting out to someplace else for the night. But then the noise did something it never did before. It moved.
It moved?
It moved. It went from sounding like it was coming from someplace upstairs or on the roof to the top of the stairs. It landed at the top of the stairs, and then it came down one step at a time. So there's a lot more about it in the book, but I'll tell you that my father described it as sounding like a child throwing a tantrum, this big, hulking child. It came down the stairs one at a time, striking each stair with this big boom. And then as it got to the bottom, there was a pause. And after a moment, it hit the landing on the first floor with a massive sound. The floor shook, as my father and my mother had described it. My father felt sure something was going to come around the corner straight at us, but nothing did, and that was it. We never heard it again. So whatever it was, whatever the source of it was finished.
But you never forgot it. Stayed in your brain forever.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, George, I mean, I really had to confront not personal demons, but professional demons in order to sort of write this and out myself at all. I mean, I'm a mainstream journalist, a
sure.
features writer, and I'm just not supposed to cover something like this, or especially something personal like this.
Were you fighting yourself to cover this?
Well, I got a lot of what would happen over the last 3 years, right, is I would tell colleagues that I was beginning to work on this. I would get what I call the second head look. And what I mean by that is I'd say, yeah, you know, I'm working on a book about the paranormal, and they'd suddenly sort of rear back and look at me like I'd suddenly sprouted a second head. And so I had to move past that, right? And I had an editor when I was doing a story about a guy you'd interviewed in the past, Lou Gentile.
Oh, sure.
I was doing a cover story about him, and I said, you know, maybe I should go ahead and write a little bit about this old family ghost story. And he just said, no way. And I understood why immediately. I mean, it could compromise my credibility. It could compromise the paper's credibility from his point of view. My first agent, as soon as I got to the word ghost, just said no. And my second agent said it would be a great third book, meaning, you know, write a couple of books, get them under your belt, have that credibility before you show people essentially that you have this second head. And I did it anyway because I kind of felt like I had to clear the decks and do some of the kind of mainstream books that I want to do, because I'm convinced, George, that people have these experiences that they at least take to be paranormal, right, far more often than they report them publicly. And if you look at polls on the subject, you regularly see, you know, 20% of people believe they've directly experienced some sort of ghost. Close to half believe in ghosts. The same essentially for UFOs, right? 20% believe they've seen a UFO. Somewhere around half, depending on the poll, believe that some UFOs might be ET spacecraft. And I just thought, you know, these stories shouldn't be stigmatized because so many people do report them. So I just felt that by outing myself, in a sense, and telling my own story, I could destigmatize these stories for some people.
And how has this affected you? You're still a mainstreamer. You're still going to write about mainstream stuff.
Yep.
How has this affected you, Steve?
Well, look, the magazine's taking me back, so professionally I'm going to be fine. Right?
They've forgiven you.
Yeah, they've forgiven me, and they're actually kind of enthusiastic about it now that they're reading it and seeing it especially. So that's good. And it left me, though, on a personal level, George, it left me open-minded about whether or not the things we see are really the things that are so. You know, it left me wondering how complete our philosophy really is. And it made me aware from a very young age of mystery. And it taught me to respect mystery, to not put a definitive answer down or say an exclamation point when we really should, if we're being honest with ourselves, be putting down a question mark. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And then this journey, Steve, took you into some incredible areas where you had an opportunity to interview some people who were directly involved in this kind of research, people who have had these life-changing events that we'll talk about tonight. But you also had a chance to talk with Edgar Mitchell.
Yeah.
He's a dear friend of the program. I love the guy. Just a tremendous person with great character.
Yep.
Believes we're being visited by extraterrestrials, which I find fascinating coming from a NASA astronaut.
I sure do too, George.
Tell me about your meeting with him.
You know, it's funny, you know, you use that word love, right?
Yep.
Because as a journalist, you're supposed to stay certainly removed from your sources. And it's not as if Dr. Mitchell and I have any sort of personal relationship at this point. But while I was with him, and we talk about this sometimes, right, when amongst ourselves as journalists, sometimes you just fall in love with someone you're covering. And that's the way I felt about Edgar Mitchell. I was so impressed. His family journey, George, in 100 years from covered wagons to the moon. Amazing.
And as,
right?
I've told Edgar, he's old enough, he could have been in the covered wagon at the time.
You know, I shook his hand, and I couldn't get over the fact that I was shaking a hand that had been on the moon.
I know. Right? It's fascinating. I had dinner sitting next to him in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. He has been on my programs locally and nationally for years.
Mm-hmm.
But now I'm getting that opportunity to meet him, to be with him, and it's just, it's mind-boggling. And you're absolutely right, that feeling of shaking hands with someone who was off this planet.
Yeah.
It's truly remarkable, isn't
it? Yeah, it's absolutely remarkable. And I really felt personally that chapter of the book and that experience of meeting him, both in sort of in my personal life and then within the narrative of the book, it is kind of a fulcrum point, right, where things just sort of pivot or turn. Because his journey is that transformational, and the fact that he had the bravery he had to follow that experience in the space capsule, for those who don't know, right, that Dr. Edgar Mitchell, on his way back from the moon, had this epiphany, and it's an experience that people compare to sort of the peak meditative experience.
That's right.
And it was his aha moment, as he likes to put it, where he not just realized or intellectually understood some sort of connectedness among all things. He felt it in his bones, and, you know, to use a word that he probably wouldn't use himself, right? His soul, in a metaphorical way, his soul. at the very least in a metaphorical way, right, George? maybe literally. And it changed him, and he let it change him. And it takes bravery to do that. And I personally get frustrated sometimes because, you know, George, you know, there's this sort of almost like this little war that not everybody knows is going on between skeptics and believers.
Oh, that's right.
And his story is often used, it's almost like politics, right? His story is used as a political football. And some people try and use it to talk about how, you know, you can be fractured and your filter can be damaged. And other people use it to talk about how the world is far stranger than we know.
Well, I've always said if Edgar Mitchell says it, you can take it to the bank.
I have to tell you that his personal integrity and his—and sometimes you can just feel that coming off someone, right? I mean, that sense that here's a guy who's telling it to you as he sees it and as he lived it to the best of his ability was really unparalleled. You know, that was one of the things that made me have that little experience along the way of falling in love with him,
yeah.
You know, just feeling like this is a special guy.
Well, you look for ways, you look for something, and you're saying to yourself, okay, why is he making this up? Let me see his face. Let me watch his inflections.
Yep.
And then you come to the conclusion, he's telling the truth.
He's so matter of fact about it that it's sort of stunning. And by the way, George, that's an experience I had throughout the reporting of this book to some extent, right? With Mitchell, it was magnified. But generally speaking, the people who've experienced these sorts of things are nowhere close to crackpots, right? They are normal people, regular people,
yes,
who experience something strange. And when they do tell you about it, you can really feel that. But if you only see clips on TV or hear a soundbite, or I hope when people read about it in this book, they get in touch with that, right? But if you only pick up on it in the ways it's usually portrayed in the mainstream media, you may not really see this, that these are normal people reporting strange events.
Would you say that nearly everyone, in some form or fashion, Steve, has had some kind of paranormal experience in their life?
You know, I'd have to crunch the numbers from, say, like the Baylor Religion Survey. That's one of the most authoritative on the subject. But certainly there's a Gallup poll that has over 70% of the public reporting belief in some aspect of the paranormal. The Baylor Survey had it at somewhere around 68%. What's interesting is you'll come across people too, George, who had something really, really strange happen to them, but refuse to apply a paranormal label to it.
Absolutely.
Right.
They will reject it outright.
Yeah, it's a knee-jerk reaction. I mean, look, I have faith in a little bit here at the magazine as well. Like I said, I mean, I'd get these second-head looks, you know. But what happens after that, George, is that people will pull you aside later and say to you, you know, this happened to me or that happened to me. And I've certainly had that kind of experience multiple times. And look, the book just came out today. So I'm sure I'm going to have a lot more experiences like that now that I've got the book out.
How about that for timing, by the way, huh? I love it. Fringeology, by the way, is the name of the book by Steve Volk, V-O-L-K, and his website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. If you're not by a computer, it's Steve Volk, V-O-L-K.com. We're going to have some fun with this, Steve, when we come back. We're going to get into some more of these cases that you've studied throughout the night on Coast to Coast AM. Well, for just 25 cents a day or less, depending on the package you want, you can become a Coast Insider and do all kinds of great things, magical things. Simply go to coasttocoastam.com. When I come back, we're going to continue talking with Steve Volk. His book just out, Fringeology, Fringeology. We'll be back. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Stephen, let's start with an overview of the book, if you could. Tell us the overall concept of it, how you put it together, the kind of research that went into it.
Well, you know, George, I just felt like I wanted to not only research that family ghost story, but I wanted to take the obvious next step to me, which was to sort of peel back the covers on the entire world of the paranormal. So I tie together a lot of topics: ghosts, telepathy, life after death, UFOs, spoon bending. I get into prayer and lucid dreaming toward the end of the book because I thought a lot over the years about how there's a kind of stigma that attaches itself socially to subjects like these and like my family ghost story. So I wrote the book with two goals in mind. One was to kind of rescue these stories because I think, as we said before, people sometimes feel like they need a permission slip to talk about the strange things that happen to them. So the book is kind of a 300-page permission slip. It's a long permission slip. And if you know, so if you believe something odd happened, you don't keep quiet about it. Tell it. And the title, George, for me, it's meant to be ironic. We push these topics to the fringe, but in actuality, they're fundamental because telepathy, UFOs, ghosts, prayer, these subjects actually raise the biggest questions we ever ask ourselves. Are we alone in the universe? What happens when we die? Is there a God? What does it really mean to be human? And over time, it seemed to me that the paranormal might lead us to answers, and the book organizes itself around that idea, around this quest for answers to the big questions. And I'll tell you, George, the way I researched it and reported it was exactly the way, and I just always figured that this was possible, right? Just the way I research and write about anything else. So I would start by reading up on the subject as much as I could, finding a story that to me seemed somehow emblematic, and then I would go to that location, if at all possible, and speak to people who'd directly experienced it or get them on the phone if I couldn't do that.
Did they feel comfortable talking to you?
Not always, not at first, because I think that they have that sense. I referred in the last hour how, or the last segment, how Edgar Mitchell sometimes gets used as a political football, right? Like, what do you make of his story?
Right.
It becomes a litmus test. And I think people are used to seeing that happen, and they'll read, say, a UFO witness will read the sort of pejoratives that are often applied to people who see UFOs, and they don't want to take part in that, and they don't want to be subjected to that. So they sort of have to vet me initially to make sure that I'm not going to wound them, essentially, and that I'm really going to be open-minded and listen to what they have to say.
Well, you know, that's very possible, too, and I can understand how they feel because, you know, if they feel they're going to be interviewed by a skeptic who's out to railroad them,
right,
they're not going to talk to you.
Right. I mean, it's perfectly fine and normal and healthy and good to be skeptical in the traditional meaning of the term, but it's sort of become subverted now because the professional skeptics community just listens for the details they can explain in some prosaic fashion, and then kind of focuses on those and dismisses the rest. I mean, that's at least the accusation leveled against them, and I found it to be accurate in many, many cases that that's what they do. And, yeah, why would anyone subject themselves to that?
Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, in her work on death and dying, I think was one of those who opened up the door for this subject, for this topic. You interviewed one of her research partners. Tell me about it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess people know enough of the story of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, right?
And well, give us a little highlight. Some people don't. You know, believe it or not, we've got a lot of young people that listen to this program now, Steve, and they probably don't know who she is or was.
She's that person who has affected your life or the life of your loved ones, certainly those who've already passed on, whether you realize it or not, because she became famous as the author of On Death and Dying, which, you know, everyone should read. She sat and listened to terminally ill patients at a time in the 60s when terminally ill patients were ritually ignored. The medical profession itself seemed to, and I mean ignored psychologically, right, in terms of what they needed at this time in their lives. The medical profession kind of operated in a state of denial and often wouldn't even tell their sickest patients that they were dying. So Kubler-Ross sat with them, she heard their stories, and she wrote this titanic book that really did change the world. Not many authors ever get to say that, but Elizabeth Kubler-Ross could, because she forced people to confront the elephant in the room, death. Most people, even if they don't know her name, they know about the five stages of grief. You can probably recite them: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. And so with that book, published in 1969, she becomes an overnight international superstar, the very public face of the hospice movement. And, you know, in the book, George, I write about the death of my own mother who suffered from a terminal illness, because to me, that really brought home how big a contribution Kubler-Ross made to society and how important the hospice movement is. Because my mom's experience was a lot better than the experiences you read about in On Death and Dying. And so that was Kubler-Ross's achievement, right? She did that for people all over the world. Now, some people also know that 6 years later, she endorsed Raymond Moody's book, in which he coined the phrase near-death experience. The tunnel, the light, the meetings with deceased relatives, all these things that people report from a near-death experience. And she became very closely associated with NDEs and New Age thinking from that point on. But what's less well known, and to some extent nobody knows till now, just how close she came to including these stories of near-death experiences and deathbed visitations in her masterwork On Death and Dying. So, yeah, I interviewed her research partner, the Reverend Walamu Amara, who worked alongside Kubler-Ross in the 60s. And he had a different name then. He subsequently changed it. And just for the sake of convenience, I just, you know, refer to him by his current name.
Right.
And these were really some of the most moving interviews, George, that I ever personally conducted, because these two sat by the bedsides of dying patients every day, listened to them, did their best to console them, counsel them. And they endured, because of that, an awful lot of suffering really themselves by taking in all these stories of pain and regret. Dreams that would never be achieved.
That would wear me down.
Well, it would wear down anybody, right? Could you imagine that's how you spend your 8 hours every day? And they were in uncharted territory, too. I mean, Kubler-Ross became famous precisely because there wasn't a lot of literature available already, virtually none, about what it was like to go through a terminal illness. So
she was even ahead of Raymond Moody, wasn't she?
Oh, by 6 years,
yeah,
ahead of Raymond Moody. And look, in psychological terms, she was ahead of everybody because nobody had ever sat with this many patients as they were dying before and listened to the stories they had to tell. And here's where the story turns, right? Because they didn't just hear stories of suffering. They had patients spontaneously tell them about other things that happened to them. For instance, when they were resuscitated, they would recover enough after the resuscitation. Maybe they'd had some traumatic event, an accident or a heart attack. They'd wake up ultimately and they'd report what struck both Reverend Amara and Kubler-Ross at the time as impossible things, you know?
Yeah.
So they'd talk about the near-death experience. They'd say, I floated out of my body. I witnessed the resuscitation of my body.
I saw the light.
The light, the meetings with deceased relatives. And they seemed to describe the things they saw in the hospital room itself, or wherever they were, accurately. And it was all the elements of the classic near-death experience years before anyone heard the term. So this is in the 60s, and Moody's book doesn't come out until 1975, actually putting forth that this is something that goes on, and say 10% of the resuscitation cases might report this. The numbers vary depending on the study you're looking at, but something like 10%. And so if that wasn't enough, George, to set them back a few steps, there was another class of paranormal experience, and these would be the deathbed visitations that patients often told them about too. And this was when a desperately ill patient would report seeing a deceased relative or loved one there at their bedside. And George, this clearly, I mean, for a lot of people, and even for me, this sounds like, initially, this must be some sort of delusion or illusion. This person is ill. But if you work in a hospital, you do see people caught up in an illusion and who reach in some sort of delusional state pretty frequently. Certainly Kubler-Ross and Amara were familiar with this. And this seemed different. So people who were experiencing some sort of illusion, they seem incoherent and unaware of the other things going on in the room around them, aside from the kind of fantasy thing they're focused on.
Sure.
But these people were quite lucid. They seemed perfectly aware of their surroundings, and they could even carry on conversations, I'll just put it this way, right, with both sides, so to speak, the people there in the room with them and the people that no one else could see.
Can you imagine what it was like for Kubler-Ross and her assistant to hear these stories for the very first time? Truly before anybody even documented them in a book form.
Right.
And to hear these similar stories from people, I mean, it must have been hair on your arms would pop up.
Yeah, and they didn't believe them, I mean, initially they didn't believe them and they didn't know how to react. And it's funny to say that, right? Because Amara is a reverend. And you would think that, you know, as a reverend, he has some belief in the afterlife. But it's a weird thing with paranormal experiences. Like, people at the far poles of belief and unbelief, so people who are, say, dogmatically committed to some religion, or people who are dogmatically committed that there can't possibly be any truth in any of this, they both tend to reject these sorts of experiences. It's the people in the middle who tend to be open to them. And so Reverend Amara really rejected this. And Kubler-Ross, as Amara puts it to me in the book, was sort of knocked from her moorings by it. And can I give you a quick example of one of these deathbed visitation stories,
George? Sure, absolutely.
So Amara told me about visiting a little girl who was dying. He had spoken to her many times. And one day, as he was starting a shift, he went in to say a quick hello to her. So she has a terminal illness, and she was one of his patients, and Kubler-Ross's patients. And the girl started telling him a story about a man who visited her earlier in the day. And she was being very light and pleasant about it all, but she said that she didn't know who this visitor was. It was a man. She described him as having been very kind. But, of course, Amara saw this as a very serious security breach. A stranger had come and talked to this vulnerable little girl who's confined to a hospital bed. So in front of the girl, he remains calm and asks her for details of what the man looked like, precisely because he wants to pass this information on to security. And so at that point, he takes it upon himself to stay near the girl's room to prevent this guy from coming back and also to intercept her parents when they arrive. And so when her parents get there, he pulls them aside before they can ever get to the room and says, "Look, everything's fine, but I need to speak to you." And by this time, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross herself was present. She'd been brought up to speed. And now, look, George, nobody's thinking about anything paranormal at this point. Right.
Right? They probably don't even know what that means at that point.
Right, exactly. It's not even on their radar.
Yeah.
So the four of them leave, and they go to this conference room. And Amara goes ahead. He describes what's going on with this woman's daughter, and the husband's there, too. And he describes this man, and he's just in the middle of assuring them that, look, whoever this was will not get in again, when suddenly the mother interrupts him. She asks him to describe the man a second time in detail. And when she hears the description, she swears this sounds like her own dead brother, the girl's uncle. So she's startled by this. And she stands up, she walks off to her daughter's room to hear her child describe the man. And her daughter corroborates the story a second time. Her daughter seemed to be describing the uncle she'd never met, his clothes, his manner of speaking, his physical appearance. And these were the sorts of events that did repeatedly crop up in their research. So they didn't know what to do about this. And when they first started hearing stories like this, they kind of just brushed past them. As Amara put it to me, he said, "We didn't go looking for these stories. They just kept happening again and again to us."
They would find them.
Yeah. But as time wore on, George, they figured they'd better start treating these odd stories the same way they treated everything else they learned from their patients, because they were hearing it so commonly. And as Amara put it to me, he said, "Look, we ended up filling two very, very deep filing cabinet drawers with these stories." So they took notes. They stored the information away. And I just have to say, from a psychologist's point of view, not that I'm a psychologist, but it just seems to me, from a psychologist's point of view, this would make perfect sense. She's conducting research into the experience of suffering from a serious terminal illness.
Did she even think about writing the book at that point?
Well, what was happening in the background of all this, right, is she was becoming famous for her work with the dying. And so she, around 68 or so, she's contacted by a publisher, and she agrees to write a book. She signs a book contract, and this is the part that was really new to me. Reverend Amara told me that in her original manuscript for On Death and Dying, Kubler-Ross did actually write an entire chapter that dealt with near-death experiences and deathbed visitations. She wrote that here were these experiences that at least suggested some possibility of an afterlife. So she writes this in what becomes, you know, one of the most landmark legendary books of the last century. But before sending it to the publisher, she asks Amara to come to her house because she needs his advice. This is the night before the book was due, actually, George. She was supposed to stick it in the mail to the publisher the next day.
Mm-hmm.
So he comes over and she shows him the entire book, including this chapter, and she asks him, "Do I put this chapter in?" And he talked her out of including it.
Interesting. Talked her out.
Talked her out of it. And And the obvious question, I guess, would be why, right? And this was a tough one for me because here I am tonight advocating that people feel free to tell their strangest stories without any undue embarrassment. And I stand by that. But there are exceptions to this, as there are to anything in life. And I think in this case, George, sitting on the paranormal for a time was the right thing to do. Amara's thinking, and I see his logic, and Kubler-Ross ultimately did too, is that here she was about to stick her fingers right into the eyes of Western medicine. She was already going to be saying to them, in On Death and Dying, you're doing a really bad job of caring for the terminally ill. You're harming your most vulnerable patients at the most challenging times of their lives. And she was breaking that taboo already against acknowledging and talking about openly death. So for her in that context, never mind that it's also a scientific context, right, to also suggest the possibility of an afterlife, to say that patients were reporting leaving their bodies and floating around the hospital, it was a non-starter because it just would have given the people who opposed her the ammunition they needed to undermine her and dismiss her entire life's work. And just think of all those patients around the country and the world who needed someone to speak up for them. That was certainly what Kubler-Ross thought about, and so she decided to table that chapter and to leave it out, so it never even went to the publisher.
In your research, did you stumble into stories of near-death experiences beyond the Kubler-Ross-type stories?
Well, you know, I mean, I certainly sat there and read a lot of them on Jeffrey Long's website, right?
Right.
And I read them. I couldn't read just one, right? It was sort of like potato chips. If I read one, I had to read three or four because they're fascinating. And so, I mean, I certainly did a lot of research into various near-death experiences, and I looked at a lot of the scientific papers on it. I didn't actually run across, but for a couple of sources I called, right, people with their own individual near-death experiences. I did talk to one guy that made it into the book who he was in the military, and he was pinned at some point by a vehicle and suddenly was looking at it from above.
Knocked right out of his body.
Yeah, that's the way he describes it,
yeah.
Right? I mean, incredible. And, you know, he seemed to have described everything accurately, and he kept largely kept quiet about this, as you might imagine. I mean, this was also before Raymond Moody. And that, to me, is the most fascinating part of this, George. There's no way to say that these stories are the power of suggestion. They're simply not, because people were hearing these independently from one another throughout the 1960s. You know, and that coincides with improvements in cardiac care.
Well, stay with us. Steve, we're going to take this quick break. We're already at the top of the hour. We come back, I want to talk with you a little bit more about NDEs. Part of his work that went into his book also includes UFOs and a number of other different cases. So we're going to talk with him about all things paranormal tonight, as he calls his mind-boggling journey into the world of the paranormal with his book, Fringeology. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.